We're taking stock of the Tokyo Games on the morning show, focusing on men's competition this time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Some numbers here. The U.S. leads in the total medal count with 95. China has scooped up the most golds at the moment with 34. And in all, 339 medals will be awarded across 33 sports. What sport are you following in Tokyo? Are you watching male athletes on Team USA? What story inspires you? 800-642-1234. Philip Hirsch is back. He's covered 19 Olympics, former Olympic sports writer for the Chicago Tribune for more than 30 years. Phil, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And, you know, before we dive into specific athletes and events, I want to get some of your broad stroke observations of the men's competition and the storylines you've been paying attention to with these athletes.
Well, obviously, it goes sport by sport. You've got the swimming, which has been over for almost a week. Caleb Dressel was the dominant male figure in the globally, as a lot expected, winning 5 gold medals, winning the and setting a couple of world records, winning the 3 of the shortest races, the 50, the 100, the 50 freestyle, 100 freestyle, and the 100 butterfly. In terms of other events, I mean, one of the big stories is the U.S. men's track and field team, and particularly the sprint track and field team, has had pretty much of a disastrous Olympics. They've so far, the entire medal count for track and field of the United States is only one gold medal by a man. And the rest have been by the great women athletes of this team. So we're down to basically the 5,000 meters is being run right now. And we're down then to the 4 relays, one of which the U.S. men didn't qualify for by botching a baton pass, which they seem to do with stunning regularity. Now, of course, we're left with the men's basketball final, which is going to be the United States against France late tonight. There are a number of other U.S. teams still alive for gold medals. I believe that all the other 4 are women. It's women's water polo, women's volleyball, women's basketball. Oh, no, I'm sorry, men's baseball. The U.S. men's baseball team is still in the running. They're playing in the final this, I think, Saturday afternoon.
Well, circling back to track, with Wisconsin representing on the track, Kenny Bendarek from Rice Lake, Wisconsin, he broke some records in the National Junior College Association Championships leading up to the games. Has he been overlooked? What stands out to you in his first Olympics?
He had a great performance. Everybody was presuming that his teammate Noah Lyles would win the gold medal in that event, and in that case, the attention often is on the person who doesn't live up to expectations, compared to the person who exceeded expectations. Kenny had a phenomenal performance, and he can go forward with a tremendous amount of confidence.
Yeah. So, do you expect him to improve over the years and remain at the top of runners? What might happen there?
I would say that he's got a great chance to become one of the top runners in the country to remain one of the, he is already now one of the top runners in the country. I think he's got a great chance to remain one of the top runners in the country for at least the next, the next Olympics jumps up at us because of the postponement of the Tokyo Games. So it's only 3 more years. I think you're going to see a lot more of Kenny. I mean, he had a terrific performance in the 200 meter final.
Well, you're talking also about some of the low points in track, and Clayton Murphy there, the Olympics came to an end for him and not in the way he hoped. He lacked that signature closing kick, finished last in that 800 meter final. What went on?
He just had one of those bad days. It happens to a lot of great runners. If you look at Emma Coburn in the women's steeplechase, the same, who's been a world medalist, Olympic medalist. She just had one of those with the French call un jour sans, a day went without a day. And that's, those kind of things can happen. And that's what happened to Clayton.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Phil Hirsch, a former reporter for the Chicago Tribune, has covered the Olympics for more than 3 decades. You can join in. Have been watching the men's competition this year in the Olympics. What's been your favorite events? What stands out to you? 800-642-1234. Phil, on the reverse side there, U.S. shot putter Ryan Krauser has had a really an amazing Olympics. What stood out to you with this athlete?
Well, actually, I also want to go back and give a shout out to Bobby Fink, who was the surprise winner of the men's 800 and men's 1500 meter swimming races with this unbelievable finish. I don't think people knew he was a contender. I don't think even he expected that he was going to win both of those races. Ryan Crouser's performance in the shot put was jaw dropping. He had set a world record, even though we knew how good he was. He had set a world record at the U.S. Olympic trials about 5 weeks ago. But all five of his six throws broke his own old Olympic record. And he came very close to breaking the world record again. And the most remarkable thing, not only were all those throws long, but he got through the event without a foul, and that's rare in shot put. But he has the ability to be incredibly consistent. One of the things, he's also a very smart shot putter. He knew that it was hot, it was humid, even with all the chalk that they use, the ball gets slippery, your hand gets slippery, and gets more slippery as time goes on. So he knew that it was a great idea. Normally he's a shot putter who builds his, over the six throws, who builds to his best throw. He knew it was really important to get a big throw out there on the first throw, and he did that. And then eventually on the sixth throw with the gold medal assured, that's when he had his longest throw, but he had already won the event on his first throw.
I was really moved by his story in dedicating his gold to his grandpa Larry, who had introduced him to the shot put. And it was sad to hear that, you know, his grandfather died the day he left for Tokyo.
It was a beautiful story, particularly the anecdote about him throwing the shot in his grandpa's backyard.
Yeah.
And eventually there was concrete, there was grass, and there was sand, and eventually he was able to throw the shot far enough to get it out on the sand.
And through the garden shed.
One day he threw it so far it went through the garden shed. Also you have to realize it's hard even to conceive of, that's a 16-pound ball, and you're throwing it 75 feet. That's basically you're throwing it the length of a basketball court.
Mm.
So next time you're at the end of a basketball court, take a look at that and imagine throwing and put something that weighs 16 pounds, maybe a bowling ball or something, although they're not that heavy, in your hand and try to conceive of throwing it 75 feet.
Ryan Crouser has a teammate who has also been, you know, his biggest rival, Joe Kovacs. What do you see out of American athletes like that who have these in-team rivalries?
Well, I mean, the athletes like this always say that, you know, Sydney McLaughlin said it about her competition with Dalila Muhammad, that iron makes iron sharper. Iron sharpens iron. So I think that you've seen the same thing with Kovacs and Crouser. They've pushed each other to get better and better and better. And the fact that they're U.S. teammates and that they get along makes it even better. These are rivalries that, you know, we often think of rivalries as including animosity. This one clearly doesn't. Muhammad and McLaughlin clearly doesn't in the 400 hurdles. So, if you have someone to push you, I mean, the young woman who beat Katie Ledecky in the 400 meters in their opening race at the Olympics, Ariana Titmus, said, mm-hmm. Katie gave me something to shoot for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like the U.S. men's basketball team. Once the pros went to the Olympics with the Dream Team in 1992, the rest of the world suddenly saw what the level was that they could aspire to. And if you look at the number of global players in the NBA now, that's had a dramatic impact on international basketball.
Hmm. Phil Hirsch covered the Olympics for decades as a former sports reporter for the Chicago Tribune. We're looking at the men's competition today. Yesterday, we made space to focus on women athletes. What do you think of the most decorated male swimmer for Team USA in these games, Caleb Dressel, picking up five more gold medals in Tokyo? Did you watch swimming or diving? What do you think of Team USA men's basketball going from cold to hot? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the men's competition at the Summer Games on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in the home stretch, and here come the Beijing Winter Olympics set for February. The Olympic Committee told NPR that Chinese officials are attending the games in part to monitor the effectiveness of COVID safety protocols. What do you think about these games going on in a pandemic and Japan's rising case counts? Do you think the Olympics have too many or not too or not enough sports. What moments do you remember? Join in 800-642-1234. Journalist Phil Hirsch has covered 19 of them, and he's with us for about 9 more minutes. I want to talk about anti-doping. You know, some Olympic viewers may be confused about the athletes competing this year under the acronym ROC, the Russian Olympic Committee. Can you explain that?
Well, going back to the big doping scandal at the 2014 Olympics, when it was found that Russia had developed this very intricate plan to substitute clean samples for presumed dirty samples, in other words, samples, urine samples that would have had performance-enhancing drugs in them. There's been more and more investigation of Russia, and it turned out that there was, in fact, a state-run or at least a sport-run doping scheme, centralized doping scheme in many, many sports. So over the course of time, there's been attempts to sanction the Russians for this, and actually at the previous Olympics in Rio, in track and field, there were very, very few Russians allowed to compete. Mm. You know, the problem, it's wound up being the International Olympic Committee. Putin was too important. They just basically kowtowed to Russia on this one, and they didn't sanction them seriously enough. Or else you could look at it from the other angle, which is that there obviously are clean Russian athletes, and if you ban the entire Olympic Committee, you're banning everybody for the misdeeds of some. So I mean, you can look at that, and that's the legal position that the International Olympic Committee has taken on this. The other issue that's gone on with this Olympics, normally there's a fair amount of out of competition testing that goes on, because you almost never catch anybody with a test at competition. People know they're coming; they can clear the drugs from their system or take drugs that will clear from the system. Because of COVID, the amount of out of competition testing was clearly reduced. So that's what's created some doubt about some of the performances. And it's, you know, but I think it's certainly the Russians now have a nasty recent history, and that's why they are the target of all of these suspicions and doubts. But it's unfair to say that, you know, they're the only ones doping if they are doping, because what we have learned over the years about doping, you know, in cases like Lance Armstrong and Marion Jones, is that it has been traditionally relatively easy to beat doping controls by managing the timing of the doping, by using drugs that still haven't been detectable. So I'm just saying that before you throw blanket accusations at the Russian athletes, particularly who have been competing in Tokyo, yeah, you better make sure that the glass walls in your own house are pretty resilient to stones.
Mm. I was wondering just about that, whether the strict and rigid testing that has gone on in the past has not been overshadowed a bit by managing COVID protocols in the pandemic.
It clearly has been. There was a lot of fear that there would be no testing. There has been some testing, but not as much testing as there otherwise would have been.
Well, let's talk basketball for a moment. As you know, we're home to the new NBA champion Milwaukee Bucks, so basketball is just really top of mind here. But the U.S. men's basketball team, it's had just kind of a touch-and-go start here, some cold, some hot. What's going on with the basketball team?
Well, you know, these are great players and even great players, you put out the Dream Team, which was the greatest assemblage of players ever. I mean, they were just so good that they overpowered everybody. They didn't need much time to play together. But what you've got now is a leveling of basketball in the world. You've got some really other good teams, and that's what, you know, Spain has been terrific for years. Serbia has had a good team. France, who the U.S. plays in the final, has gotten better and better. They have, I think, 3 NBA players in the starting lineup. So I think that part of the thing is that there's an assumption that the United States is going to crush everybody, and without paying attention to how much the sport has progressed globally. And that's, as I said earlier, that's largely because of the influence of the Dream Team.
Hmm. So what do you expect out of this rematch, France and the U.S.?
I expect the United States, they are getting better and better. Kevin Durant has been having a fabulous second half of the Olympics. I think that they will win this gold medal, but I wouldn't be surprised I would not be surprised if the game comes down to the final 2 or 3 minutes.
Circling back to swimming for a moment with Caleb Dressel and, you know, those 5 gold medals, 2 world records, 2 more Olympic records, do you think that Caleb's earned a seat next to superstars like Michael Phelps and Mark Spitz.
He's next to Michael Phelps is so far ahead of everybody else, particularly because some please don't take this as taking anything away from Caleb, but Caleb swam relatively short distances. Michael Phelps was swimming the 400 individual medley, the 200 butterfly, and if you think of Katie Ledecky, who swam 6,200 meters of heats and finals, that's a lot harder. Caleb, I think, Michael Phelps is really up there in all Olympic sports in terms of medal count in a league by himself. So, and Spitz, of course, but Spitz didn't compete in as many Olympics as Michael Phelps. Most athletes didn't back then because there wasn't enough ways to make money to keep yourself up. If you wanted to move forward and have a life and have a family, there wasn't a way to make enough money to live on.
Mm. Phil Hirsch with us, former reporter for the Chicago Tribune, covered the Olympics for decades. And taking your questions about the Olympics and the events, 800-642-1234. So we saw new sports at these games, karate, skateboarding, sport climbing, surfing. Do they have staying power?
Well, the International Olympic Committee has seen its audience, which is my demographic, which is old, get older and older and older. So they're trying to get younger people involved. This was the snowboarding in the Winter Olympics was one of the sports that was introduced that way. Skateboarding, the same thing. The question is, I think that younger people are probably consuming some of this, but in highlights on their phones. Whether they're watching a whole competition, I don't know, and whether it has staying power, I don't know, and whether the still primary audience for the Olympics, which is people in an older demographic, is paying any attention to skateboarding or sport climbing or surfing. It's impossible to tell that in the long run now. I think, they're obviously going to be back in the Olympics. They're also adding breakdancing in Paris. And this is, but as long as you keep sports that are old and antiquated, like modern pentathlon and some other stuff, I'm not sure that they've gotten the balance that they really want.
Well, here's a question for my 7-year-old last night, sitting on the couch watching, the 14-year-old make flawless dives. How young can you be to go to the Olympics, Mom?
That depends sport by sport. And normally, and actually in the case of that young woman who I watched and was just my jaw was dropped too, she would not even have been eligible for the Olympics if they had occurred last year. The minimum age in diving was 14, and she was not 14 last year. So, yeah, it depends. It varies sport by sport. In many sports, it's 16, 17, or 18, but it's obviously it was a 12-year-old skateboarder.
Mm-hmm.
So each individual international sport federation determines the minimum age requirements. And so she was fortunate enough that 1 year later she was able to show the world how brilliant she was. There was another great Chinese diver who was referred to last night, Fuming Sha, who was also 14 when she won her first Olympic gold medals. And I know Cynthia Potter last night on the NBC telecast was saying that last night's winner was better than Fuming Sha. And it was hard to, you watched her, the water barely moved when she cut through it on her entries. It was very impressive, and that's how it works in terms of ages. It varies federation by federation.
Okay, so I feel like I'm in a time warp here. Why do all the graphics and the images say Tokyo 2020?
Well, I think two reasons. One is financial. There would have been a lot of money spent to replace those, all of the branding, all of the logos, all of the signage, all of the everything. And so they just, I think that was the primary reason. They just decided to stick with the previous branding, and so that it is kind of confusing. I agree, but that's the reason why.
So if the stars align, we'll talk with you in February. Is Beijing ready for this? Less than 6 months to the Winter Games.
Beijing logistically is absolutely ready. Whether Beijing is ready for what is going to be a political firestorm about its treatment of the Uyghur minority in northwest China is another matter.
Mm. So what about the pandemic? Do you think that these protocols that we're seeing here in Tokyo will continue into the Winter Olympics?
Right now, when you see the news coming out of China about outbreaks in several places, including Wuhan, I wouldn't be surprised if it was another spectatorless Olympics.
Mm. Well, Phil, thank you so much for dodging and weaving with us so that you could see what you need to see and also talk with us. We appreciate it.
Well, have a great weekend. It's been my pleasure being your guest.
Phil Hirsch, a former reporter for the Chicago Tribune who covered the Olympics for more than 30 years. We talked with him yesterday about women athletes at the Games. Ahead this hour, how schools and families are preparing for the new school year. We check in with WPR's education reporter about vaccination uptake among students, what information and misinformation students are sharing, and how parents are processing all of it. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life, and this year marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's producer Carl Christensen sharing one of his favorite Wisconsin Life stories. He composed original music for the piece while exploring the meanings behind all the symbols on the Wisconsin state flag.
We've received many listener questions through WPR's Wisconsin Project. And as we combed through them, we flagged a particular question. It came from Xander, a fourth grader at Mineral Point Elementary School.
Hi, my name is Xander. What do the symbols mean on the Wisconsin flag?
So to help us decipher all the symbols on the Wisconsin state flag, and there are plenty of them, I spoke with Matt Blessing. He's the director of collections at the Library and Archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
So the Wisconsin state flag, like a lot of other state flags, was actually adopted in 1913. The main body of the flag is sort of a navy blue. Blue represents traits like wisdom, trust, truth. But in 1913, what was really important was blue represented loyalty. When you look at the elements of the state flag, at the very top of the design, you have the state's motto, Forward. Beneath Forward is a relatively small badger. You have a miner. That's a reflection of early Wisconsin history and lead and zinc mining in the Driftless area, copper mining in northern Wisconsin. And it's a tribute to Wisconsin's workers. And across from the miner on the left-hand side, you have a sailor. And between them is a golden seal that has symbols of four different trades: navigation, manufacturing, mining, and agriculture. And then smack in the middle of the golden shield is a small red, white, and blue coat of arms. And surrounding that coat of arms is the national motto, E Pluribus Unum, one out of many, a recognition of our role in the larger nation.
And then right below the miner, we see a stack of 13, what are those, lead bars?
Right. Directly beneath the miner is a pyramid stack of lead ingots. And that, again, is a little bit of mining history, a little bit economic boosterism about the state's mineral resources. But 13 is important because it's representative of the 13 original colonies.
And then next to the lead ingots, we can see everyone's favorite horn of plenty, the cornucopia.
Right. That's, of course, central to have a cornucopia about Wisconsin's agricultural history. So overflowing out of that cornucopia, you have grapes, apples, and what look like oranges. Now, I don't think oranges have ever grown in Wisconsin, so that might be something that needs to be corrected.
So I'm no Marie Kondo, but to my eye, it looks a bit cluttered. I might call it the Sergeant Peppers of state flags, yeah?
It's a little busy. to the modern eye, I think a lot of 21st century people gravitate to simplicity, which is sort of a central element in a lot of flags that attract people. But there aren't as many teaching opportunities with those flags as what you have in Wisconsin. So I still like it. I'm biased because I'm an archivist and a historian. I think we're fortunate to have a flag that we can be proud of and really be used as a teaching tool in Wisconsin schools.
That was Matt Blessing, Director of Collections at the Library and Archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Submit your own Wisconsin question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Carl Christensen.
Of school just weeks away, education leaders, they're scrambling to review their plans as the spread of the Delta variant rises. State health officials say COVID-19 cases involving children have climbed in recent weeks, along with other age groups. Are you a parent of a K-12 student? What decisions are you weighing as the new school year approaches? Is your child too young to be vaccinated? Are you worried about sending them back to the classroom? Have you made a decision about virtual learning? What is it? Join in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. In just a moment here, we're going to be talking with Madeline Fox, who is Wisconsin Public Radio's K-12 education reporter based in Milwaukee. Maddie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you've been looking at school districts without any COVID precautions in place or remote learning alternatives planned for the fall. What have you been finding?
So the thing about this year, as opposed to last year, is we don't have a statewide mask mandate in place, which means that school districts have more leeway in deciding if they want to mask this year. And a lot of them are deciding that they don't want to. Part of that is, you know, some districts made that decision at the end of last school year or earlier this summer when our cases were low, when we were thinking that there might be a vaccine approved for even younger kids sometime this fall, and they're sticking with it. I think that there's a lot of COVID fatigue and frustration in some school districts, as well as we really did kind of see the political calculus of some of these COVID precautions changed since last year, because we saw some really vicious fights over masking and and other COVID precautions during the school year last year. And so some school districts just don't really want to go through that again.
What is the messaging coming out of superintendents or principals about not putting precautions in place?
It's mixed. I think there a lot of them are urging families to, you know, be careful still. Some have emphasized to me that, you know, if families do still want a mask, I mean, it's not a mask requirement, but that doesn't mean that they're going to stop kids from masking if that's where a family's comfort level is. Or, you know, there are absolutely families where kids have underlying conditions that mean that they are very, very worried about what COVID could do to their kids. And so I've heard from some who are going to continue to mask. But some of the things that I'm hearing, and I don't know how universal this is in districts that are masking, but some of them, the school leaders are saying that, you know, they just isn't really necessarily their call, but their school board is making these decisions based on the makeup of those boards. And so it's kind of that's where they are.
What about CDC recommendations? How closely are they taking those into consideration?
So the CDC recommendations and the American Academy of Pediatric recommendations, and even the state recommendations, we got new guidance from the Department of Health Services and from the Department of Public Instruction on Wednesday about schools, and they're all very clear that school districts should mask and that everyone in a school district, even vaccinated people, even older kids who would be vaccine eligible, even staff and teachers should all be wearing masks. But again, you know, it really is, this is a place where local control, which is a feature of Wisconsin's school system, comes into play. And so the CDC and the state agencies may be saying one thing, but it's up to the school districts if they want to follow that guidance. And many of them just have decided that they do not.
And looking at vaccines, children who are 12 and older, of course, eligible for the vaccine, how often are eligible children receiving vaccines?
I believe that the rate for kids kids between 12 and 15, and then for kids under 18 but older than 15, is still lower than the uptake rate for adults. Mm-hmm. So we're not seeing them get vaccinated as often as we're seeing adults get vaccinated. It's around, I want to say, 30% for that 12 to 15 group, and I think maybe closer to 40 for that 15 to 18. So there's a decent number of vaccinated kids, but, you know, considering certainly what we're seeing, especially recently with the Delta variant, with cases breaking through vaccination, although not serious, you know, not as serious of cases, that's probably not going to protect students if the Delta variant is in their area. And additionally, you know, because it's 30 or 40% statewide doesn't mean that that's what it's going to look like, you know, in an individual classroom or in an individual community.
Do you find that there's variation around the state in vaccination rates for these younger ages and these, you know, lower teens?
You know, I haven't looked specifically at that data, but mm-hmm. I do know that we've seen variations in vaccination rates overall, you know, not split out specifically by age groups in different communities. For example, Dane County is among the higher. Milwaukee County has been a little bit lower just because of various different reasons. So I would imagine that also is similar for kids.
We are checking in with WPR's K-12 education reporter Madeline Fox. Is your school encouraging or requiring masks in person? How do you feel about the way it has handled the pandemic so far? Do you worry about learning loss? Did your child attend summer school? How did it go? What do you hope is different about this pandemic school year? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Maddie Fox here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As schools prepare to reopen for fall, many students and teachers will be reconnecting face-to-face amid the rising Delta variant. We're checking in with WPR's K-12 reporter Madeline Fox. The CDC recommends universal indoor masking for all teachers, staff, and students in K-12 schools, regardless of vaccination status. Will your school be following this guidance? Has masking been a contentious issue in your district? What information is flowing from your principal or superintendent? 800-642-1234. And Maddie Fox is with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's go to Ari now in Madison. Hi, Ari. What's your perspective?
Hi. Yeah, so I am an educator that works at a independent school here in Madison. Our name is Milestone Democratic School. And I'm just really impressed with how our school district has been handling the COVID policy with requiring all students and staff members, whether or not they're vaccinated, to wear masks indoors and outdoors, except for lunch. As well as, I wanted to mention that there are, there's a lot of contention around the vaccine. Specifically, there are some religious concerns, and I'm just really impressed with how our school has been able to handle these concerns and the passion of the staff members who are willing to get tested twice per week. Just to uphold their, you know, in order to uphold their religious beliefs. So, still keeping the students safe and still, you know, respecting everybody's needs and beliefs.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for that perspective. Maddie, does that echo elsewhere? Have you heard that?
That specific situation, I haven't heard as much. I do know definitely that that's one of the in places that are putting in vaccination requirements. That is one of the things we're seeing, that if you won't get vaccinated or you can't, then the requirement is to test once or twice a week. So that would make sense. But yeah, I think that is one way that a lot of schools are going to, which is the masking, except for at recess. That seems to be pretty safe from what we're hearing and from what I'm hearing from health experts, and at lunch. Although, of course, when kids are inside unmasked, like during lunch, they recommend that we expand to that 6 feet of distance rather than just the three, which is mm-hmm. the new CDC recommendation.
There were so many logistical concerns around busing last school year as some, you know, schools went back in person. Will busing be different this year?
That I actually don't know as much about. You're kind of getting ahead of me on a story that I'm working on for next week.
Oh, well, let's look at this week at the information teens are sharing about vaccines on TikTok. You looked at social media. What kind of information is being shared?
Well, it's social media, so pretty much all information is being shared, and a lot of it not good. Although, you know, again, you know, you can find good information anywhere. It's just that on social media, sometimes it's hard to fact check it in the moment. So when I look specifically at TikTok, that is a particularly tricky one, because unlike places like Twitter or Facebook or, well, not so much Instagram, I think that also falls in this bucket where it's the social media network doesn't really link out. There's just a feed of information. And the other thing about TikTok is it's pretty much entirely, what you see is almost entirely determined by TikTok's algorithm, because most of the time that people spend on TikTok, they spend on the For You page, which is sort of auto-populated one video after another by the algorithm. And so if you watch one video that has somebody saying wrong information about a vaccine or pushing vaccine skepticism, and you watch it all the way through, the algorithm says, oh, you must like that. And so they'll keep feeding you that information. And then, and this is true for everyone, not just for kids, you know, the more that we see information that's false, the more we tend to believe it. And if we keep seeing more information that reinforces that, we just kind of get this sort of tunnel vision where we assume that we're getting all the information, even though we're not. And so when I was working on the story, I talked to the mom of a teenager who had gotten some of this TikTok misinformation and was really worried about getting the vaccine.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, once upon a time, peer pressure used to really be something. And now we're seeing, of course, pressure play out in social media. But if your friend gets vaccinated, wouldn't that best friend teenager also want to get vaccinated?
So that depends. I mean, and the thing is, because social media is its own form of peer pressure, right? You are seeing other people your age in many cases, you know, in TikTok's case, staring directly at a camera and telling you something. And so that can also feel like somebody, you know, meeting you at your level, which especially if you're in that sort of tween to teenage is really where you get a lot of your information. You know, you tend to, that's the age where you start listening to and taking cues from your peers more than like your parents or other adults. Mm-hmm. So yes, sometimes, you know, and they do recommend if you've got a teenager or a tween in your life who's getting misinformation, they will often take those corrections and those fact checks a little bit better from someone their own age than they might from a parent or an adult. But sometimes, you know, especially with misinformation, a lot of the places where misinformation takes hold is when we're scared, which is absolutely where a lot of us are after this year. And so sometimes that can make it so it's easier to take in the bad information or to take in the scary information, and that kind of overpowers the good information.
We're talking with Madeline Fox, WPR's K-12 education reporter based in Milwaukee, as we discuss issues that school districts are facing as they prepare for fall. Is your child too young to be vaccinated? Are you worried about sending them back to school? What information has been flowing from your school about the pandemic and how the protocols will be this fall? 800-642-1234. Maddie, what ways are parents trying to combat misinformation among their kids?
Well, I think that there's a few different ways they're going. Again, like you said, you know, that peer relationship is important. So trying to sit kids down with cousins or friends or other people their age who have not fallen into that same misinformation trap helps. I talked to this mom whose daughter was worried about the vaccine because of misinformation she'd seen, and she's taking her to her pediatrician because they have that pre-existing, you know, long-term trusting relationship with a pediatrician. So she's hoping that will help, especially because this girl specifically had worries about health side effects. And so they're figuring, you know, if it's a health question, the doctor might be able to help out. So it's, you know, it's the thing about misinformation that's really tricky is it's much easier to combat it when it's starting or before it happens than it is to really combat these beliefs once they're kind of entrenched, which happens kind of fast at times.
Let's turn to the mixed status families, the concerns about having mixed vaccination status. Some people vaccinated in your home, some not, as we head into another academic year. What are you hearing?
Well, with families where, say, just the parents are vaccinated or just the adults are vaccinated, or maybe some of the siblings are old enough to be vaccinated, a lot of them are still kind of acting like, to some degree, like they were before they got the vaccine. You know, they're trying to keep gatherings more outdoors when they can. They're wearing masks. And sometimes that's shifted a little bit. So, like, the kids who are not vaccinated yet will be wearing masks in places where that's still required for unvaccinated members. And definitely putting off some things like longer term travel or plane travel. So again, you know, Delta kind of complicates that conversation because, you know, where before earlier this summer, we could feel a little more confident that those vaccinated members wouldn't be able to bring the virus back home to the unvaccinated members of the family. That's not as much of a guarantee anymore.
So I know busing is one thing you're keeping an eye on. What else are you paying attention to as the new school year approaches so fast? My goodness.
Oh, my gosh, so many things. So some school districts are starting new or kind of continuing and more formalizing the virtual options that they had last year because they're seeing that there's a need for that in their in their populations. And so I'm trying to figure out what that's going to look like. What they're thinking about for that, whether that's going to be a new normal moving forward or if they expect it to be something that they'll keep going for several years or if it's just kind of a wait and see to see how it goes this year. So that's one thing. And then I think definitely a lot of questions about, you know, how schools and teachers are going to identify students that that had a hard time learning last year and getting them up to speed. And also, the biggest question that I have is definitely how schools are going to meet the social-emotional needs of kids who really did have a challenging couple of years.
Oh, so much. Maddie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Madeline Fox is Wisconsin Public Radio's K-12 education reporter based in Milwaukee. Just ahead, we talk with a respiratory therapist about lung health. Stay with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.